wringing another shriek from my sore throat.
"Chain her!"
Dwalia shouted at someone, and Vindaliah stepped forward to kneel on me and wrap a chain around my throat and fasten it tight with a clip. I seized the chain in both hands, but Dwalia had the other end and jerked it hard.
"Up!"
she shouted.
"Up and run! Now!"
She did not look back, but hurried down the street in a lumbering trot. I went stumbling after her, clutching at the chain around my throat, trying to tear it from her grip. She passed over and among sprawled figures, and I was forced to jump over the fallen people or step on them. They seemed stunned, some twitching, and others sprawled lax on the paving stones. Dwalia turned abruptly, and we went down an alley between two tall buildings. Halfway to the next street, she halted in the darkness, and a sobbing Vindaliah came blundering into us.
"Silence!"
she hissed at him, and when I opened my mouth to scream, she jerked savagely on the chain, slapping my head against the wall beside us. I saw a bright flash of light, and my knees gave out. Some time had passed. I knew that. Dwalia was yanking on the chain around my neck. Vindaliah was plucking at me, trying to pull me to my feet. Using the wall, I staggered upright and looked around dazedly. At the other end of the alley, lanterns bobbed and voices were raised in horror, confusion, and commands.
"This way,"
Dwalia said quietly, and then gave a fierce jerk on my leash that brought me to my knees again. Vindaliah was still sobbing softly. She turned, slapped him as if she were hitting a mosquito, and walked away. I got to my feet in time to save myself from another fall. I tottered after her, feeling sick and weak. Vindaliah moved one of the hands he'd had clapped over his mouth to muffle his sobs.
"Cough?"
he dared to ask.
"Useless,"
Dwalia snapped. Vindictively she added,
"Let them have him. He will keep them busy while we find a better place to be."
She looked back at Vindaliah.
"You were almost as useless as he was. Next time, I will leave you behind for the mob."
She increased her pace, annoyed that I was walking fast enough to keep slack in the chain. I groped for whatever clip Vindaliah had used to fasten it. My fingers found it, but I could find no way to open it. She gave the chain another jerk and I stumbled after her again. Dwalia led us out into a street and uphill and away from the tall buildings near the harbour. Always she chose to go where there were fewer people and lanterns in the streets, and those we passed seemed to find nothing unusual about her hauling me along. Vindaliah followed us, hurrying to catch up, then falling behind, sniffling or sobbing or panting. I didn't look at him. He was not my friend. He had never been my friend, and he would do anything to me that Dwalia told him to do. We turned down a dark road lit only by the lights coming from the houses. They were not prosperous homes. Light shone through cracks in the walls, and the street was rutted and muddy. Dwalia appeared to choose one at random. She halted and pointed at it.
"Knock on the door," she ordered Vindaliah. "Make them want to welcome us."
He gulped back a sob.
"I don't think I can. My head hurts. I think I'm sick. I'm shaking all over. I need..."
She clouted him with the free end of the chain, jerking me to my knees as she did so.
"You need nothing. You'll do it right now."
I spoke in a low, clear voice. "Run away, Vindaliah, just run away. She can't catch you. She can't really make you do anything." He looked at me, and for an instant his little eyes grew big and round. Then Dwalia struck me twice with the loose end of my chain, hard, and Vindaliah fled up to the doorstep of the run-down house and hammered on the door as if to warn of fire or flood. A man snatched the door open and demanded, "What is it?" Then his face suddenly softened, and he said,
"Come in, friend, come in, out of the night."
At those words, Dwalia hurried toward the door, and I was forced to follow. The man stood back to let us in. As I followed Dwalia across the threshold, I saw her mistake. The young man holding the door and nodding was not alone. Two older men sat at a table, glaring at him and us. An old woman stirring a kettle over a low fire in the hearth demanded of him,
"What are you thinking, bringing strangers into their house in the dead of night?"
A boy about my age looked at us in alarm and immediately picked up a stick of firewood, holding it like a truncheon. The woman's gaze had snagged on Dwalia's face.
A demon? Is that a demon?
Vindelire turned back to Dwalia with a face full of woe.
I can't do this many people anymore. I just can't.
He gave a broken sob.
All of them, Dwalia demanded shrilly. Right now!
I had been at the point of stepping over the threshold. I took a firm hold on my chain below my throat and stepped back as far as I could.
I'm not a part of this,
I shouted hopelessly. Everyone in the little house was staring at us in consternation and fear. My shout broke them.
Murder! Demons! Thieves!
The woman shrieked suddenly, and the lad sprang forward at Vindelire with his chunk of firewood. Vindelire threw his arms up over his head, and the lad delivered several sound thwacks to him. Dwalia was backing hastily out of the door, but not in time to avoid the heavy mug one of the men flung at her. It struck her in the face, sloshing beer over her and making her yell angrily. Then she was away, dragging me after her. Vindelire came behind us, yelping as the lad landed blow after blow on his shoulders and back, while his father and uncles cheered him on. We ran on, even after the family had given up their pursuit, for the shouts and clatter had roused other folk in the row of simple houses. We fled them, though Dwalia soon dropped her run to a shuffling trot, and then to a hasty walk, as she looked back over her shoulder repeatedly. Vindelire caught up with us, holding his head with both hands still, and sobbing brokenly.
I can't, I can't, I can't,
he kept saying until even I wanted to strike him. Dwalia was leading us back toward the town. I waited until we were in streets where the houses were sturdily built, with glass in the windows and wooden porches. Then I set both hands to the chain, set my heels, and jerked it as hard as I could. Dwalia did not let go, but she halted and glared back at me. Vindelire stood beside me, his mouth loose and trembling, hands still on his battered head.
Let me go, I said firmly, or I shall scream and scream and scream until this street fills with people. I will tell them you are kidnappers and murderers.
For a moment, Dwalia's eyes went wide, and I thought I had won. Then she leaned in close to me.
Do it, she dared me. Do it. There will be witnesses that recognize us, I don't doubt. And there will be folk who will believe that you were our partner, the servant girl that led us in to rob and kill that woman. For that is the tale that we shall tell, and Vindelire will make Kerf agree with it. We shall all hang together. Scream, girlie. Scream.
I stared at her. Would that happen? I had no one to vouch for my tale. Trader Acriel was dead, cut to pieces. Abruptly that loss hit me like a blow to the belly. She was dead because of me, as Vindelire had warned me would happen. I'd left that path he spoke of, and again, someone was dead. My wonderful idea of escaping Dwalia hung in tatters around me. I did not want to believe Vindelire's superstitions about the path. It was stupid and ridiculous to think there was only one right way for me to live my life. But here I was again, alive when those who had helped me were dead. I wanted to weep for Acriel, but my grief went too deep for tears.
I thought not.
She mocked me, and turning away from me, gave a vicious jerk on the chain. It ripped from my bruised hands, and I found myself following her again as she led us into the dark.
Chapter 16. The Pirate Isles. I have dreamed of the theft of a child. No, not dreamed. For 6 nights this nightmare has howled through my sleep, a dire warning. The child is snatched, sometimes from a cradle, sometimes from a feast, sometimes from a morning of play in fresh snow. However it happens, the child is lifted high and then falls. When the stolen child lands, the child has become a scaled monster with glittering eyes and a heart full of hatred. I am come to destroy the future. These words are the only part of my dream that is always the same. I know I am but a collator, with no more than a drop of white in my veins. Over and over I have sought to tell this dream, and always I am pushed away, told it is just an ordinary nightmare. Beautiful Symph, you are my last hope that I will be heard. This dream is worthy of being recorded in the archives. I tell it to you not to gain glory for myself or be recognized as a wight who can dream, but only because...
Text charred away. Discovered among Symph's papers. The long, slow days aboard Paragon lodged in my life like a bone in the throat. Each had been so much like the last that it seemed like one endless day, and each choked me with its dragging passage. Most of the crew's enmity was focused on me and Amber. Their simmering anger made our brief and meager meals daily trials for me. Amber had destroyed not just Althea and Brashen's livelihood, but theirs as well. Securing a berth on a live ship was seen as a lifetime position, for the crew was well paid, safer than on an ordinary ship, and became almost a family. Now that would end for all of them. From the youngest, who had earned his position only 6 months ago, to the oldest, a man employed on Paragon for decades, their livelihoods were gone. Or would be when Amber supplied the ship with enough silver to transform himself. For now, they were hostages to Paragon's ambition. As were we. Spark and Purr were pitied more than reviled. Clef still seemed intent on completing Purr's education as a deckhand, and I took comfort that the lad had time that was not focused on our differences with the crew. Lant continued to share Clef's room, and Clef moved Purr in with them. I wanted to thank him for keeping the lad close and safe from any resentment, but feared that any conversation would taint Clef with the dislike I had to bear. To avoid exacerbating the discord, I kept mostly to the cabin I now shared with Amber and Spark. Spark had become subdued and thoughtful. She spent more time strolling on the deck with Lant than she did trying to learn knots or run the rigging. Spring had warmed to summer, and the tiny chamber was often muggy. When Lant and Purr crowded in with us to practice our language lessons of an evening, sweat rolled down my back and plastered my hair to my head. Even so, it was a welcome diversion from the enforced idleness I endured. When we were alone during those long days, the fool and I pored endlessly over Bee's books. He sought further clues from her dreams. I desperately wanted to believe that she might still be alive somewhere, even as the thought of my little daughter held captive in such ruthless hands tormented me to sleeplessness. He asked me to read to him from her journal as well, and this I did, somewhat. I could not tell if he knew I skipped passages and entries that were too painful to share. If he was aware of it, he said nothing. I think he realized I had been pushed to my limit. Yet the fool was far less restricted in his movements than I was. As Amber, he moved freely on the deck, immune to the displeasure of the crew and the captains, for she was favored by the ship. Paragon often required her presence for conversation or music. It was a freedom that I envied and attempted not to resent. Yet it made for long and lonely evenings. One evening, after Amber had left the chamber to spend time with the figurehead, I could stand the small, close room no more. With only a slight twinge of conscience, I rummaged through the substantial wardrobe packs that Spark and Amber had brought aboard. I found the wondrous elderling cloak folded into a very small packet, butterfly side out, and shook it. Most elderlings were tall, and the cloak was cut generously. I hesitated. But no, it had been Bee's treasure, and she had given it to Purr to save him. In turn, he had surrendered it to the fool's use without a murmur. And now, it was my turn. I donned it, butterfly side in. It fit in that uncanny way that elderling garments had of adapting to the wearer. The front fastened with a series of buttons from my throat to my feet. There were slits for my arms. I found them and lifted the hood to cover my head. It fell forward over my face, I had expected it to blind me, but I could see through it. I watched my disembodied arm reach for the door handle. I opened the door, drew my arm in, and stepped out. I stood still, allowing the cloak to adopt the dim color of the passageway walls. I soon discovered what a burden a floor-length garment was. I moved slowly, but still stepped on the front hem more than once. As I explored the ship unseen, any ladder I ascended required that I wait until no one was near, for I had to hike the cloak up to climb. I wondered if the ship was aware of me, but did not wish to test that by venturing too close to the figurehead. I ghosted about, moving only when no crew were near and choosing my stopping places carefully. As night deepened, I moved more boldly. I found Purr sitting on the deck next to Clef in a circle of yellow lantern light. I remained outside its reach.
"It's called marlin spike work," Clef was explaining to the boy. "You use the spike off a marlin's nose, or some do. I just use a wooden fid, and you take the old line that's no good for anything else, and you sort of weave the knots, and you can make mats or whatever you want, see? Here's one of the first ones I made. Useful and pretty in its way."
I stood soundlessly nearby and watched Clef walk the boy through starting the knot center. The work reminded me of Lacey, busy with her needles and hooks. She'd made lovely things, cuffs and collars and doilies, and few were the ones who knew that the sharpened tips of her needles were her clever weapons as Patience's bodyguard. I drifted away from them, wishing that Purr could give up his fierce loyalty to Bee and become a ship's boy. Surely that was better than being involved in assassin's work. I went in search of Lant. Since the crew's feelings toward us had darkened, I worried for him more than I liked to admit. If any of the crew were to seek a target for their anger, it would most likely be Lant. He was young and able-bodied. It would not be seen as cowardly to provoke him to a fight. I had warned him often to be wary of hostility. He'd promised to be careful, but with a weary sigh that said he believed he could take care of himself. I found him standing on the dim deck, leaning on the railing and looking out over the water. The winds were favorable, and Paragon was slicing the water smoothly. The decks were almost deserted. Spark was beside him, and they were conversing in low voices. I drifted closer. "Please don't," I heard him say. But she lifted his hand from the railing and stepped inside the circle of his arm. She leaned her head on his shoulder. "Is it because I'm low-born?" she asked him. "No." I saw how difficult it was for him to remove his arm and step away. "You know that's not it."
"My age?"
He leaned on the railing, hunching his shoulders.
"You're not that much younger than I am. Spark, please. I've told you, I've a duty to my father. I'm not free to..."
She leaned in and kissed him. He turned his face toward her, letting her mouth find his. He made a low sound, pleading. Then he abruptly gathered her in and molded her body to his, pushed her against the railing, and kissed her deeply. Her pale hands moved to his hips and snugged her body tight to his. She broke the kiss and said breathlessly,
"I don't care. I want what I can have now."
I stood in numbed shock. He kissed her again, then, with a discipline I envied, he took her by the shoulders and pushed her gently away from him. He spoke hoarsely. "There are enough bastards in my lineage, Spark. I won't make another one, nor will I break faith with my father. I promised him, and I fear those words will be the last ones he heard from me. I must see this through to the end, and I will not chance leaving a fatherless child behind."
"I know ways to prevent..."
But he was shaking his head.
"As you were prevented? As I was?"
"No."
"You told me what Amber said to you, that in all likelihood she and Fitz will both die. And as I am sent to protect him, that means I will die before he does. It will shame me enough to leave you without a protector, though I hope that Purr will stand by you. But I'll not chance leaving you with child."
"I'm more likely to end up protecting Purr."
She tried to take his hand, but he clamped his fingers to the railing. She contented herself with covering his hand with hers.
"Perhaps I'll die protecting you before you die protecting Fitz," she offered,
but her laugh was not a merry one. I moved softly away from them, scarcely able to breathe for the tears. I hadn't realized I'd begun to cry until I'd choked on them. So many lives contorted because my father had given in to lust. Or love? If Shade had not been born, if I had not been born, would other players have stepped into our roles? How often had the fool told me that life was an immense wheel, turning in a set track, and that his task was to bump the wheel out of that track and set it on a better one? Was that what I'd witnessed tonight? Lant refusing to continue the Farseer tradition of hapless bastards? I drifted back to the privacy of the room, closed the door behind me, removed the butterfly cloak, and folded it carefully as it had been. I wished I had not worn it. I wished I didn't know what I knew now. I put the cloak back where I found it, resolving I would not use it again, and knowing that I lied to myself. Paragon was selecting our course now, with little regard to what Althea or Brashen might wish. Bingtown had been left far behind, with no pause. We had neither dropped off cargo there nor taken on supplies and water. We had threaded our way along the shifting coast of the swampy shores and entered the waters of the pirate islands. Some of them were inhabited, and others were wild and unclaimed places. It made no difference to Paragon. We might look longingly toward tiny port towns alight at night, where we might have put in to take on fresh water and food, but he did not pause. On we went, as relentless as the sea itself, and our rations grew ever smaller.
We are prisoners.
The fool sat up from where he had been lounging on the lower bunk in the sweaty cabin and leaned out to give me a look.
Do you speak of Althea and Brashen? You know why they have cautioned you to keep mostly to our cabin.
Not them. Under the circumstances, I think they have been very tolerant of us. It is Paragon who has taken us prisoner. I lowered my voice, painfully conscious that I could not tell what the liveship was or was not aware of within his wooden body. He cares nothing now for Althea and Brashen's contracts and deliveries, nothing for our comfort and safety. He does not care that we are ill-supplied for this voyage, having failed to take on supplies in Bingtown. Short rations mean nothing to him. On he goes, through night and storm. When Althea ordered the sails reefed, he rocked so violently that she called her crew back from going aloft.
He has caught the current,
the fool said.
Even without sails, we would be carried through the pirate islands and past Jamalia and on to the Spice Islands beyond them. He knows that, and the crew knows that.
And the crew blames us for our situation. I sat up slowly in the cramped top bunk, careful of my head on the low ceiling of the cabin. Coming down, I warned the fool, and left the upper bunk. My body ached from inactivity. I don't like it when Lant and the youngsters are gone for so long. I'm going out to check on them.
Be careful,
he said, as if I needed a warning. When am I not a cautious fellow? I asked him, and he lifted his brows at me.
Wait, I've decided to go with you,
he said, and reached for Amber's skirts that were wilted on the floor. The fabric rustled as he drew them up around his hips. Must you? He frowned at me.
I know Althea and Brashen far better than you do. If there is trouble of any kind, I think I am the better judge of what to do.
I mean the skirts. Must you continue to be Amber? His face grew still. He spoke more quietly, the skirts drooping in his hands.
I think that adding any other difficult truths to what the crew and the captains must absorb right now would only make our lives more difficult. They knew me as Amber, so Amber I must remain.
I don't like her, I said abruptly. He gave a caw of laughter.
Really?
I spoke honestly. Really, I don't like who you are when you are Amber. She's not a person I would choose as a friend. She's conniving, tricky. A half-smile curved his mouth.
And as the fool, I was never tricky?
Not this way, I said, but wondered if I lied. He had publicly mocked me when he thought it was politically advantageous, maneuvered me into what he needed me to do,
Still, I did not modify my stare. He cocked his head at me.
I thought we were past all this, he said softly.
I said nothing. He bowed his head as if he could see his hands as he fastened the waistband of his skirts.
It is my best judgment that they continue to know me as Amber, and if you are leaving the cabin to look for the others, I think it best I go with you.
As you wish, I said stiffly. Then childishly, I added, but I am not waiting for you. I left the small space, shutting the door not loudly, but firmly behind me. Anger was a hot boil inside my throat and chest. I stood for a time in the passage, telling myself that it was simply close quarters for too long, and not true anger I was feeling for my friend. I took a deep breath and went back out onto the deck. A fresh wind was blowing, and the sun was shining, scattering silver on the water. I stood for a while, letting my eyes adjust and enjoying the wind on my face. After the crowded cabin, it felt as if I had the whole world around me. The dancing water that surrounded us was dotted with green islands in the distance. They rose abruptly from the water like mushrooms sprouting up from the forest floor. I drew a deep breath, ignored the sullen stare of Cord, who had paused in her work to watch me, and went to find my straying wards. I found Spark and Purr leaning on the railing beside Lant. Spark's hand was all but touching Lant's on the railing. I sighed to myself. All three were looking morosely out over the water. As I took a spot behind them, Lant glanced back at me. All well? I asked him. He raised a brow. I'm hungry. None of the crew will speak to me. I don't sleep well at night. And how are you? Much the same, I said. The captains had reduced the rations for everyone. On the day Paragon had bypassed the channel that would have taken us to Trader Bay and Bingtown, the captains and crew had confronted him.
I won't be tied to a dock,
Paragon had declared.
I won't allow you to trick me into having lines roped to me so you can drag me aground on a beach.
It's not about trying to thwart you, Brashen had said. It's purely about taking on some water and food, delivering the cargo we were to leave there, and sending some messages back to Bingtown and Treehog and Kelsingra. Paragon, we have simply disappeared to those people. They will think the worst has befallen us.
Oh, the worst.
His voice had grown sly.
So they will think the mad ship has rolled and drowned another crew.
There had been acid in his voice, and his dragon eyes had whirled swiftly.
Isn't that what you mean?
Anger had spasmed over Brashen's face.
Maybe. Or maybe our Bingtown merchants and our Rainwild clients will think we've become thieves, taking their goods and running off to sell them elsewhere. Maybe we'll lose the only things left to Althea and me, our good names.
The only things, the ship demanded. Did you spend every penny of Igrot's treasure then? That was a fair windfall for you when I took you to that.
There's enough left perhaps to commission an impervious ship to replace you, one of wood that would let us lead a simple life, if anyone consented to trade with us again after you've made us liars and cheats.
Replace me? Ha! Impossible. I am the only reason you have ever prospered, you spendthrift, spoiled son of—
Stop this!
Althea had intervened, stepping closer to the figurehead, apparently without fear.
Paragon, be reasonable. You know we need fresh water to drink. You know we need food. We didn't supply for a long voyage. We had enough on board to get us to Bingtown, and a bit extra. That was all. And we're days past that. If you make us just keep going, we're going to die of thirst. Or starve. You'll get to wherever you're going with a deck full of bodies, including Amber's. Then how will you get your silver and become dragons?
There was no rationality in those spinning blue eyes. He turned his gaze out over the water.
There's plenty of fish you can eat.
So we'd sailed on,
and Althea and Brashen had cut the rations. And yes, there were fish in these waters, and moisture in the cooked flesh. The crew had pulled enough aboard each day to eke out the hard tack and salt meat that was left to us. We'd had two spring storms, and Althea had ordered out clean canvas and channeled rainwater into barrels to replenish our meager stores. And still we sailed on, through the region known as the Cursed Shores, with its shifting sandbars and toxic waters, and on until we began to see the scattered islets and then the islands of the Pirate Isles. Motley swooped down and startled me by landing on my shoulder. "Well, where have you been?" I greeted the crow.
"Ship?"
She spoke the word urgently.
"Ship? Ship? Ship?"
"We're on a ship," I conceded to her.
"Ship! Ship, ship, ship!"
"Another ship?" Per asked her, and she bobbed her head wildly up and down and agreed.
"Ship, ship!"
"Where?" I pushed the word at her with wit as well as voice. As always, I felt as if I shouted down a well.
"Ship!"
she insisted and launched from my shoulder. The wind caught her and flung her skyward. I lifted my eyes to follow her flight. Up she went, and up far higher than the ship's mast. There she hung, rocking in the wind.
"Ship!"
she called, and her word reached us faintly. Ant had been halfway up the mast. At the crow's call, she looked around, scanning the full horizon before climbing even higher. When she reached the crow's nest at the top of the mast, she scanned the horizon, then, pointing,
"Sail!"
she called. In an instant, Brashen had joined Althea on the deck. They both looked up, following Ant's finger. Brashen's face was grave.
"What's wrong?" I asked Amber softly.
"It's probably nothing," she replied. "But at one time, passage through the Pirate Isles might have cost your life, or your freedom, or your cargo. When Kennet was raiding these passages, he built an empire going from pirate captain to king. He didn't ransom the ships he captured. Instead, he appointed one of his loyal men to be captain and sent him out to raid, taking a share of whatever loot he captured. He crewed his new ships with escaped slaves, or sometimes with the very men they had defeated. From a single ship, he went to two, then half a dozen, and then a fleet. He became a leader, and then a king."
She paused.
"A fairly good king, as it turned out."
"Yet an evil bastard of a man."
Althea had approached quietly as Amber was speaking. Amber turned, showing no evidence of surprise.
"That, too, is true, according to some."
"According to me,"
Althea said brusquely.
"But now the Pirate Isles are themselves plagued with pirates, and if it's not a pirate ship that overtakes you, it may be one of the tariff ships come to collect a passage tax, like pirates, but with far more paperwork."
She turned to Per.
"That crow of yours, he talks. Is there any chance he could tell us what ship he has sighted?"
Per shook his head, surprised to be singled out.
"She says words, but I'm not always sure she knows what she's saying, or that she could tell one sort of ship from another."
"I see." Althea fell thoughtfully silent.
"Are you worried what will happen if that is Vivacia or another live ship?"
Amber dropped the question as if she were plopping small stones into a quiet pond. Althea's response was so calm, I wondered if she had forgiven Amber.
"The thought occurred to me. Yes, it's a worry. We can't know yet how the silver will affect Paragon, or if he can ever transform completely into a dragon. I'd sooner not create misery for every live ship and live ship family until we know how his experiment will end."
I felt Brashen coming to join us before he stepped into my peripheral vision. He had the presence of a predator, and my wit sense of him was edged with scarlet anger. I managed to keep my hands lax and my shoulders lowered, but it was not easy. Althea's mouth moved, as if she considered words and rejected them.
"Right now, Amber, you have a better connection with Paragon than either Brashen or me, and I have to ask you to use whatever influence you have with him."
"What do you wish of me?"
If that sail is a live ship, we judge it best to stay clear. However, if it is an ordinary wooden ship, we'd like to come alongside and see if we can buy provisions from them. Anything would be welcome, but chiefly we need water.
She shifted her gaze to me.
In the rain wilds, we take on rainwater from wooden cisterns high in the trees. It's expensive, and we try to take only what we need. The river and its tributaries are usually unsafe to drink from.
She sighed.
To ration food is harsh enough, but soon we'll have to cut the water allowance again, unless Paragon allows us to put in at one of the pirate islands and take on water, or we encounter a ship that has enough fresh water to wish to sell some.
I watched her shoulders rise and fall with her deep sigh. Then she rolled them back, squaring them, and I felt my admiration for her rise. She possessed the sort of grinding courage I had seldom seen in man or woman. Facing the end of all she had known as her life, the end of all she had expected her life to be, she would nonetheless think not only of her crew, but also of those who crewed the other Bingtown liveships. And of the ship she still loved, even as he prepared to abandon her. Verity, carving his dragon. That was who she reminded me of. Amber spoke my question aloud.
So, you have forgiven me?
Althea gave her head a short shake.
Not any more than I've forgiven Kennet for raping me, or Kyle for taking Vivacia from my care. For some things, there is no forgiving or unforgiving. They are simply a crossroads, and a direction taken. Whether I would or no, someone else set my feet on that path. All I can control is every step I take after that.
I'm sorry, Amber said softly.
You're sorry? Brashen asked incredulously. Now you say you're sorry?
Amber lifted one shoulder.
I know I don't deserve forgiveness for what I've done. I don't want to seem as if I expect it, based on old friendship. Yet I say it now to let you know it's the truth. I'm sorry that it was what I had to do. Althea is right. Events set my feet on a path. All I can do is take the next step.
She's flying Pirate Island colors,
Ant called down to us.
And she's tacking to cut our path. Moving fast, too.
Most likely a tariff ship,
Brashen suggested. He scowled toward the horizon. If it is, it will be sure to intercept us, to demand to inspect our cargo, and to charge us for passage through these waters.
And as we are carrying elderling artifacts from Treehog and Kelsingra, items that were originally destined for Bingtown, the value they will assign, and hence the tariffs on that value, will be far beyond our ability to pay. We will be detained in the Pirate Isles and given a choice between sending for the funds or surrendering part of our cargo to pay the tariff. Cargo that is not ours to use to pay our debts. Cargo we were contracted to transport to Bingtown.
Althea spoke as if the words were made of thorns. Brashen laughed without humor.
And if we refuse to be boarded by the Pirate Isle tariff agents, or if we refuse to follow them to port until the tariff is paid, then they will endeavor to force their way onto Paragon and take control of him, and we have no idea how he will react to that. Actually, I fear that I have a very clear idea how he will react, Althea said. I think he will do his best to sink the other ship with little mercy for the crew.
She shook her head bitterly before turning back to Amber.
And so I am going to ask you to use every bit of influence you have to persuade him to be reasonable, to let them come alongside and talk with us. There will be trouble over the tariffs, but at least putting into port will give us the chance to take on food and water, or to release our crew.
Release the crew?
There was alarm in Amber's voice. Althea was resolute.
As many as will go, whatever is to become of Paragon and of us, I see no point in taking them all with us. The sooner they are off Paragon's decks, the sooner they can find other employment, other lives.
How can Paragon get to Clarys with no crew?
Amber demanded.
Skeleton crew.
She looked Amber up and down.
You'll have to lose those skirts and remember how to work the deck again.
She tipped her head toward me.
Him too, and Lant and the youngsters.
I opened my mouth to respond, but Amber spoke quickly.
I'm blind, but what I can do, I will. We all will, and I will do all I can to encourage Paragon to be reasonable. I've no wish for this to be any worse than it must be.
Any worse?
Brashen said softly, a terrible wandering in his voice.
How could it be any worse?
As if in answer to his question, a wave of something swept past me that spun me like a weather vane. It seemed as palpable as the wind, but it was not air that slid past me, but skill and wit, twined together and moving through the wizard wood of the ship, in a way I knew, but did not understand. I knew it, for I had done it. Done it without thinking or understanding it in the days when I had first begun to try to master my magics. I had done it because I had not known how to separate them. I had been told my skill was tainted with the wit, and I had known that my wit had undertones of skill to it. I had struggled to separate the two, to use the skill properly, and I had succeeded. Almost. But now I felt it rippling and surging through the ship, and it felt not wrong, but pure, as if two halves of something had been restored to a whole. It was powerful, and for a time I could focus on nothing but the wonder I felt at it.
Oh, no!
Althea said in a low voice, and that was when I knew the others were aware of it too. All of them stood still, faces frozen, as if they were listening to the distant howling of hungry wolves. Everyone, save Perseverance, who looked from face to face, and then demanded,
What is it?
Something's changing.
Spark whispered. Transfixed as I was by the flow of magic, I still noted in a small corner of my mind how her hand crept out to grasp Lant's forearm, and how he set his hand over hers to reassure her. Something was changing indeed, and it wasn't just the ship. I felt Amber catch hold of my sleeve. Althea and Brashen moved, as if one will controlled them, striding toward the foredeck. Overhead, Motley still circled, cawing.
Ship! Ship!
We followed, and Clef came dashing past us, as abruptly as the surging magic had begun. It passed. Althea and Brashen had gained the foredeck. Paragon twisted slowly to look back at them.
What?
He asked mildly, raising a questioning brow. I had a single instant of disconnection before the obvious stunned me. He looked back at us with my face, save for his pale blue eyes.
That's exactly how Prince Fitzchivery looks when he's puzzled,
Purr observed, answering a question I hadn't even formed in my mind. Slowly, Paragon turned away from us. He lifted his arm, offering the back of his wrist to the sky. Motley swooped in to land there, completing my utter confusion.
Ship!
She told him.
I see it. It's a tariff ship. We'd best heave to, and then let them know we'll be following them to Divytown to pay our taxes.
He glanced back to give his captains a boyish grin.
Vivacia is out of Divytown, isn't she? I have a feeling she'll be there. It will be so good to see Boyo again, won't it? And Queen Etta has her court there. Perhaps at last Paragon Kennetson will see fit to walk my decks. Let's put on some more sail and pick up some speed.
Paragon, what are you playing at?
Brashen demanded in a low voice. The figurehead did not turn back toward him.
Playing at? Whatever do you mean? Why have you resumed your old face? Brashen asked. Because I did. Isn't this the one you prefer? The one that makes me seem more human?
You are human.
Amber spoke her words with soft clarity.
Human and dragon, possessed of the memories of both, soaked in the blood and the memories of those who have crewed your decks, bled and died on them. You began as the shells of two dragons, that is true, but you have become something that is not only dragon, but imbued with humanity as well.
Paragon was silent.
Yet you changed your face, Amber continued, so that Boy O would see you in your familiar guise and not be alarmed. I wondered if she was guessing or if she knew.
I changed my face because it suited me to do so.
Paragon spoke the words defiantly. Amber's response was mild.
And it suited you to do so because you care for Boyo. Paragon, there is no shame in being who and what you are, in partaking of two worlds instead of one.
He turned to look at her, and the blue of his eyes was dragon blue.
I shall be dragons again. I shall.
Amber nodded slowly.
Yes, I believe that you will, as will Vivacia and the other live ships. But you will be dragons as dragons have not existed before. Dragons touched with humanity, understanding us, perhaps even caring about us.
You do not know what you are saying. Dragons shaped by human touch? Do you know what those are? Abominations. That is what they are. Those who hatch and grow on Other's Island. Those who are as much human as serpent. And hence neither, and never will they be dragons. I shall be dragons.
I made little sense of this outburst, but Amber seemed to understand it.
Yes, yes, of course, you will be dragons, and the part of you that will remember humanity is not in your wing or your tooth or your eye. It will be in your memory, as the serpents of the sea recall the memories they need of those who were serpents before them, and as a dragon recalls his ancestral knowledge. You will have an additional pool of memories, your human memories, and it will give you wisdom beyond what other dragons have. You and the dragons who have been live ships will be dragons apart from the ordinary, a new kind of dragon.
He turned away from all of us.
You have no idea what you are suggesting. Look, soon they will be hailing us. Should not you be about your duties?
The Tariff ship's captain was a young man. The red beard that edged his chin was patchy, and though he wore a fine hat with several immense plumes in it, I think he was relieved when Brashen shouted to him that we were Divitown bound to submit for taxing.
I'll follow you then,
he declared, as if he had been about to demand that we submit.
Go ahead and try.
Paragon invited him affably, and indeed, once we were underway again, he demonstrated the difference between a live ship and one made of wood. Given the same wind and current, we pulled steadily away from the Tariff vessel. Truly, if Paragon had wanted to run from him, the Tariff ship's chase would have been futile. No one asked us to leave the deck, and so I stood by the rail with my small retinue, enjoying the wind on my face. How does he do it? I asked Amber, and felt Purr step closer for the answer.
I don't truly know. He smooths his hull, I think, and unlike many other ships, a live ship will never develop a beard of weed and muscles. His hull never needs to be scraped and painted, and no tube worm will ever hole his planking.
For the rest of the afternoon, we watched the islands grow closer. Soon, even Paragon had to slow in order to thread his way among islets to what had once been a hidden town, a place where pirates went to divvy their spoils and drink and gamble and take every pleasure they could. Once, it had been a place where escaped slaves could go to begin a new life as free folk. I'd heard tales of it as a noisome place of stagnant water, patchwork hovels, and sagging wharfs. But Paragon followed a well-marked channel into a tidy harbour where large sailing vessels, obviously merchanters, were anchored in the bay, while smaller ships and fishing boats were tied to an orderly array of docks. A prosperous little city spread back from the harbour in a grid of streets and alleys. Trees I did not recognize lined the streets, heavy with yellow blossoms. The main street led to a large structure about the same size as the manor house at Withywoods. But there, the resemblance ended. Queen Etta's palace was of plank, painted white with long open porches on the front. A green surrounded it, so that even from the harbour it was visible past the rows of warehouses and storefronts. As I looked, I realized that the height of the buildings had been reduced to have exactly that effect. The royal residence towered over the town and, from the upper balconies and tower, had an unimpeded view of the harbour.
"Is that the Vivacia?"
Lant asked. I turned my gaze. "I don't know, but she's definitely a live ship. She was a queenly creation, a youthful woman with her head held high and her shapely arms and wrists crossed at her waist. Her hair was a black tumble of curls that fell to her bared shoulders and over her breasts. I saw in her proud features an echo of Althea, as if they were related. As Spark described the vessel to Amber in a low voice, Amber nodded.
"Vivacia," she confirmed. "The Vestrit family liveship. Command of her was snatched away from Althea by cruelty and strange turns of fate. Her nephew, Wintrow, commands her now. Brashen served aboard her for years, as first mate under Althea's father. This will be bittersweet for both of them."
Vivacia rocked gently at anchor in the harbour. Paragon's sails were slowly gathered in, and when a small flotilla of dories came out to meet us, lines were tossed, and Paragon surrendered his motion to their command. I paid small attention to any of that. Instead, I stared at Vivacia as we drew nearer. She turned her face toward us, and at first it was the look of a woman interrupted in her private musings. Then, as she recognized the ship, a smile dawned on her features. Vivacia held out her arms in welcome, and despite all that had befallen Althea and was yet to come, I heard our captain call a joyous greeting. The dories pulled Paragon into position, facing Vivacia, and his anchor was dropped. A longboat moved out from the docks and came alongside us, and a woman in an extravagant hat and a well-tailored jacket over black breeches called out that she would be pleased to transport the captain and a manifest of our cargo to the tariff house. Althea called back that she would be pleased to accompany them in a short time. Would the tariff officer wish to come aboard and view the cargo, as there were unusual circumstances to be explained? The officer was so inclined, but I was distracted from that process by what was taking place on Paragon's deck. With various shades of reluctance and anger, the crew were assembling. Most had brought their ditty bags from below. The canvas sacks were not large, but contained most, if not all, of each sailor's possessions. Ant was weeping silently, the tears streaming down her face as she bade farewells. Cord threw her bag near the girl and hunkered down beside her. The look she gave us was hostile. I made a decision that surprised me, for I had not even realized I was considering it. "Lant, a word with you," I said, and led him apart from the others. I leaned on the railing, looking up at Divytown. He took his place beside me, a slight scowl on his face. I suspected he knew what my topic was, but doubted he knew the direction of the discussion. I waved at the city. "It's not a bad place. It looks clean, with legitimate businesses, and there's a lot of trade and traffic through here." He nodded, a frown building between his brows. "You and Spark could do well here, and I'd be grateful if you took Purr also. Take the gifts we were given in Kelsengra. Be careful how you sell them. Get full value. There should be enough money to keep you all for some time, and enough to send Purr back to Buckkeep." He was briefly silent. When he turned to stare at me, his eyes were flinty. "You've made some assumptions about me that I don't care for." "Have I?" I asked him coldly. "I see how she follows you. I see her hand on your arm." Then what should have been righteous anger suddenly melted into weariness. "Lant, I hope you truly care for her. She isn't a serving girl to be romped and set aside. Shade chose her. She came with us, and I never expected any of this to happen. I wish she had stayed with him, but she's here, and I expect you to...
You're insulting me, and her.
I stopped talking. Time to listen. The silence ate at him until he filled it.
We do share an... attraction. I don't know how you think it could have become more than that on a ship as crowded as this one. And no matter what she feels for me, her loyalty to Amber is greater. She won't forsake her.
I bowed my head to that.
I doubt you will as easily believe what next I tell you. My father asked a task of me, and I said I would do it to my utmost ability. If you cannot accept that I might feel some loyalty to you, then know that I am my father's son. I may not perform to the level you expect, but I will stay at your side until this thing is done, one way or another.
His voice suddenly grew thicker.
I did not do well with B, not when I tried to teach her, not when you left her in my safekeeping. She was a strange and difficult child. Don't bristle at me. You must know it's true. But I should have done better by her. Even if protecting her with a blade was never something I expected to do, she was my cousin and a child in my care. I failed her. Do you not think that I have agonized about that? Going to avenge her is something I have an interest in, beyond any duty to you or my father.
The fool thinks B might still be alive. That brought his eyes back to meet mine. I saw pity in them.
I know he does. But why?
I took a breath. B kept a journal of things she dreamed. I've read the entries to him, and he thinks they have meanings beyond what I understand. He believes B had foresight, and that some of her dreams predicted she would survive. His face was still for a moment. Then he shook his head.
That's a cruel hope to dangle in front of you, Fitz. Though were we to find her alive and bring her home, it would lift a great weight of guilt from my shoulders.
He paused. I could think of nothing to reply to that. Then he went on.
I say this as a friend, if you ever considered me so. Fix your course on vengeance, not rescue. There's no guarantee of the latter. We may not have success with the former either, but I am determined they will know we tried.
A friend. My mind snagged on that word. And I wondered if I did feel he was a friend. I knew I'd come to rely on him, and now I had to admit that some of the anger I'd felt about his possible involvement with Spark was that I knew I had to release both of them. I asked the worst possible question, thoughtlessly. Then you and Spark are not... He stared at me.
I don't think you have the right to ask either of us that question. You may not have noticed, but I am a man grown and of noble birth. Not your equal, perhaps, but not your serving man. Nor is Spark a servant to you or anyone else. She is as free to choose her course as I am.
She is under my protection and very young. He shook his head.
She is older than she looks and more experienced in the ways of this world than many a woman twice her age. Certainly, she has seen more of the hard side of life than Shun ever did. She'll make her own decisions, Fitz. And if she wants your protection, she'll ask for it. But I doubt she'll ask to be protected from me.
I did not think our discussion was over, but he turned and walked away, and when I reluctantly followed him, I found only Purr waiting with him.
Where are Amber and Spark?
Lady Amber went to change her clothing. Althea asked that she accompany them on shore. Spark went to help her. Evidently, Althea and Brashen think Amber should be with them when they sit down with Admiral Wintrow Vestrit. To discuss our future. The crew has been offered shore leave, which is, I think, an invitation for them to jump ship here. 2/3 of them have accepted it.
Small boats had already ventured out from the town. Vendors in the little boats were hawking everything from fresh vegetables to free rides to Auntie Rose's lady house. I watched our crew departing, ditty bags on their shoulders, as they climbed over the railing and down to the waiting dories. A few were clustered near the foredeck, bidding Paragon farewell. The ship was kind to them, but unswerving in his determination. Across the stretch of water that separated us from Vivacia, she watched us expectantly, eyeing every small boat that departed from ours.
Ant stood beside Clef, watching her fellows leave. Kittle stayed. Cord left. Twan went to the railing.